Welcome to the Fun and Sobriety Podcast. I'm your host, Dylan. I am an alcoholic. Today is a conversation with a friend and a colleague who I have known for a few years now, someone I met during my time in a graduate program to become a clinical mental health counselor. She and I just happened to enroll at the same time. I don't know if we enrolled at the same time, but we happened to be going through the program at the same time. And through those years together, I was a cohort model, so we got to go to every class together effectively, and through that time get to know each other fairly well. And she is another person who has her own history with addictions and a colorful past. So please enjoy this conversation between me and Collins. Because I noticed your birthday was a couple weeks ago now. But
3/16.
Oh, okay. So basically a month ago.
Yeah, 3/16/14.
3/16/14.
So 10 years.
Okay. So anyway, welcome to the Fun and Sobriety Podcast.
Thank you.
My name is Dylan. I am an alcoholic. I'm sitting down with a friend and a colleague, Collins. I'll just give you the single name Collins.
Hi, folks. I am Amanda, and I, too, am an alcoholic and an addict. And now you know my full name, which is, you know, broken rule number one.
I'll do a bleep out of that. No, I'm just kidding.
No, leave it. It's fine. I'm a rule breaker. It's what I do.
Yeah, so I noticed that right away.
I did it when I was using, and I do it in sobriety, so.
Yeah. God dang it. Sorry, there's like dog hair on my microphone. Sorry. Anyway.
You good?
I feel awkward. Do you feel awkward?
No.
Okay, good. You look very comfortable. I wanna just.
You look like you are experiencing a first date.
Sure. Part of it is like I was starting to explain, and then I decided to hit record. So why not capture all this gold? It's been a while since I've recorded an interview with someone. I had a friend reach out after I had put the podcast on pause. Because he was celebrating 1 year and he wanted to, like, I don't know.
Shout out.
Yeah, he wanted to shout out. And so that was the last one I published prior to since the pandemic. And then during that time, I met you, right? And the context of that is we both enrolled in a program to become mental health counselors. And so that was part of why I put it on pause. I don't know why I pretend like there's an audience out there that's wondering what happened to me when the podcast went away. But during that time, it was a cohort, so that it was you and me and like four other people. And
crawling through a graduate program.
Right.
That was horribly grueling.
Oh my gosh, relax.
And it took our blood. It took our plasma every week.
Oh my gosh.
No, it didn't.
No, but
it was a lot. We had a lot to do in a short amount of time.
And we all came to know each other pretty well, right?
Yes.
And I don't know. Two things that made you and I, to me, feel like you and I connected a little bit more than maybe other people together or us with other people. And maybe I'm speaking out of hand, but for me, definitely, I felt more connected with you than anyone else, partially because we're older than most of the people in the program, right? We were several decades older than most of them, to be frank.
They're puppies, yeah.
But that's not necessarily a disconnect other than, you know, experiences. But also, you're a comrade in recovery, let's say, right?
Yes. Yeah, and I'm really open about it.
Yeah.
So I charge into a room and I lead with it a lot.
What does that mean?
I think that because there is such a huge stigma to the word addiction, I try to show people that there are people all around them who struggle with substance use disorder, and they all look very different, and their experiences are very different.
Yeah.
And if we continue to hide that part of who we are, we're just feeding the stigma. So I sort of walk in bold with it, and a few other things.
Even before our program, I mean, you're using terminology from the program, or that I at least adopted from the program. But even prior to that, you felt that you led chin first. You led with it.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. It's a huge part of my life. It's a big part of my story.
Yeah.
It's a part of who I am. And it's a part of how I live. So if people don't know that part of me, it would be like not telling them that I'm queer, or not telling them that my parents are dead, or, you know, I mean, it's a part, a huge part of my story. So it makes up sort of the foundation of who I am.
Yeah.
So not leading with that seems like I'm showing up as less than.
Ingenuine. Yeah. Or is that a word? Non-genuine?
Disingenuous.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So tell me about this. So what is your drug of choice?
So I was an opiate addict.
Okay.
And honestly, God, I love my mother. My mother has passed. My mother is going to reach down from wherever she is energetically and smack me when I say this.
What?
When I was 3 years old, I developed ear infections. And I, like a lot of kids, got like one after another. Like I had tube issue, you know, so I always had an ear infection. It was like in my right ear. Every time I got an ear infection, the doctor would prescribe this wonderful liquid called Paragoric.
Okay.
And it made the pain go away. And it made me sleep, which made my mom happy. Well, it was opium.
Really?
And
where was this? Where were you?
Northern Virginia. Okay. So not Arkansas. No offense to Arkansas. But, you know, I was a Beltway kid, right? We were educated, and
oh my God.
No one knew what opiates would do to you.
Okay.
And so I kind of think of myself as, you know, the first time I tried an opiate, I was 3.
For real? So
and I really, really liked it.
Well, sure.
So did my mom.
So story, you reflect back to as that early in your
history. I mean, now that I'm sober and I can think back, and I'm not blaming my addiction on my mom. There's no one to blame for substance use disorder.
Okay.
It's a disorder. But if I want to say, where did it start?
Sure.
It started when I was 3. When I was about 13, my ear infections went away. And
So you were being given Paracor? Is that what it's called?
Paragoric. Parapectalin.
For 10 full years, your whole developmental, early developmental period.
Okay. Wow. So think about what the brain is doing, right?
From that explains so much about you.
Right? Right. It's amazing. Why I sometimes don't remember pants. Like all the things.
To be clear, she's wearing pants right now.
I'm wearing pants right now. If that makes you feel better. So from 3 to around 13, 12-ish, I was getting fairly regular doses of this amazing magical elixir.
Okay.
By the time I was about 5, I noticed that I wanted it.
Hmm.
And I could sort of start to manipulate adults to get it.
Huh.
'Cause 5-year-olds are smart.
Sure.
So by the time I'm 12, the ear infections pretty much go away because you grow out of them. I got drunk for the first time, like solidly hammered
at 12,
and lied about it at 13.
How does a 13-year-old get enough alcohol, get hands on enough alcohol to get blackout drunk?
Not that it takes my that much, best friend, my best friend was house sitting, and I went with him to watch the house. And we were like supposed to water the plants.
Sure.
And, you know, it was like, we'll give you $5, water the plants, take in the mail. And they had a liquor cabinet.
Yeah.
And I found it.
I just had a memory of that like childish experience of hard liquor going down your throat. That like
I can't
burn knowing that it's wrong, and or I don't even know what the right word is because it hurts, but it's like something solid, like you dig it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it puts out the fire of the fear. Right.
Ooh, like talk
there's
about that.
There's like this fear of we're doing something wrong and we're being bad and we're experimenting. Sure. And
it's middle of the day. So that middle of the day
it was
drunk.
Like two o'clock in the afternoon. And I mixed all kinds of, you know, we had no idea what we were doing.
Sure.
So we just tried everything. Ugh. And so the guy that I was there with just started throwing up. He was such a lightweight. So I look back at it now and I'm like, oh my God. Like the first guy I got drunk with was a complete pussy. Like what? Wow. That just started my career in such a fantastic way. But so he started throwing up. He was so sick that we had to go get our parents.
Oh. Oh.
Well, he was a wuss when it came to drinking, but he was also very noble. And he said that I was waiting outside the house. Oh. And that he went in to water the plants and he got drunk.
So he protected you from...
He did.
And at the same time, you were fucking sloshing.
I was hammered. Like, I can't even tell you. I should have thrown up and I didn't. I've never thrown up from drugs or alcohol, which is
really
bizarre.
That's especially a career that spans a good 30, 40 years.
I have a good solid career.
Wow.
It's the best career I've had, really. Oh, the most successful career I've had. The
most consistent and successful.
It's in drugs and alcohol. So, So I just went along with it and I got away with it.
Hmm.
And so my little brain went, holy shit, I can get away with this. Like parents are going to believe me. I can lie about anything now. I'm untouchable. Hmm. And then I started smoking weed a lot. And then I started stealing pills.
Stealing from whom?
Anyone.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, medicine cabinets. You go to a friend's house, you go to their bathroom to pee.
Oh, I see. And just grab whatever.
But it was, I found opiates again.
Hmm.
And yeah. So between pills and heroin and thank God fentanyl wasn't around, wasn't a thing. I had an illustrious career. Yeah.
So that's early. That's like junior high years.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you had a professional career. So talk about getting through all those years.
Yeah, like, I was pretty good at keeping it mostly to pills and alcohol.
Okay.
I found, trigger warning for anyone listening. Trigger warning, trigger warning. We need like a siren. like woot, woot. If you have a problem with opiates, please turn off the podcast now.
Oh, here you go. Oh God, like literal trigger.
I found out that whiskey and pills, that combination was lit. Like that was my thing.
Sure.
So once I did that, I really didn't use heroin that much.
So wait, when did you first use heroin? I mean, opium from a pill form feels a little bit more, I don't know, middle class.
Yeah, socially acceptable.
Socially,
but heroin back then was pretty highbrow too. Like it wasn't junky heroin. This was good shit.
How are you finding it?
Well, I lived in a very wealthy neighborhood.
Oh, okay. So it was just rich kid shit.
Yeah.
Oh.
Were you slamming it or snorting it? I was a badass because...
I was a badass.
Because I was doing heroin and everybody else was doing cocaine.
So it was all snorting?
Yeah, okay. It was snorting.
Okay. Did you ever inject?
I did slam twice and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
It was terrifying.
The idea of it wigs me out, but
it wigged me out too. I hate needles, despite the tattoos. I hate needles.
Feels like a different kind of needle.
It's completely different.
Yeah,
it's very invasive.
You're not trying to get into a vein. You're just
vein rape. It's not vein rape. So,
wait. So you're doing like straight heroin at what age?
15, 16.
Jesus Christ, dude. Okay.
Yeah, and
This is like the Basketball Diaries shit.
No, it really is not. I don't want to romanticize anything because sure. my privilege kept me out of trouble. Let's be clear. Like,
okay.
I am sitting here because of privilege.
Okay.
And I am acutely aware of that.
Yeah, this is, and, you know, despite our time in the program together, I guess we didn't spend a lot of time talking about history. So, I mean, I'm unaware of that. So you were raised in a upper middle class kind of environment.
Yeah, gated. I was raised in a gated community.
Really?
Okay. Called Barrister's Place.
Nice.
Off okay. of Lawyer's That's Road.
Pretty much all you need to say.
Yeah, we lived on Statute Lane. I'm not kidding.
Were your folks lawyers?
You can't make this stuff up.
No, but
my folks were educators. Okay. But we lived in a neighborhood that was all white,
yeah,
all upper middle class, mostly government, right? Okay. Beltway.
Okay.
So
okay.
mostly like, and I grew up with ambassadors' kids and government, like
okay.
Pentagon, okay. you know.
Well, and you have a very distinct look about you right now. Talk about the way you looked back then. You look around as though you don't.
I'm like,
you're covered in tattoos. You have your head shaved. You have
true.
Two, what are those, size 12 grommets in your ear.
Okay. So I do have my head shaved and I have some tattoos. As a kid, I was very girly.
Okay.
I should have brought a picture. To
I wish
show
you had. I really cannot picture it. I literally
after the podcast,
picture it.
I may have something.
Yeah,
on my
send
phone
me if you can
after
send
the
me
podcast,
some. Yeah,
I have a picture of myself at when I was like first addicted. So at about
oh.
six.
Well, if you're oh my gosh,
I'll show it to you. So I had long hair and it was always like pulled back here
okay.
and then long and flowing.
Okay.
Usually wore a dress unless I was playing. If I was playing, I was in shorts.
When was the last time Amanda Collins put on a dress?
So the last time I put on a dress was actually the night before I got sober.
Oh, really?
So it was 3/15/14. I was doing a benefit called Dykes and Drag.
Okay, that makes sense.
As a fundraiser.
Okay.
That picture I have on my phone for you.
Oh, please forward that to me as well.
And
oh my
God, drag
yes.
must... My drag mother, Chase Manhattan, made me up, and I lip synced to this Lord song that
yeah.
was really big back
sure.
in the day, and
Royals.
Yes,
Royals.
I was in this long, beautiful gown.
Do you have, by any chance, a YouTube clip of this?
Because
I want that.
I do not, because here's the deal: I promised my wife at the time that I wouldn't drink whiskey. Because
okay.
she's like, you're going to be in a green room with a bunch of drag queens for 5 hours while they make you up, and I'm not allowed to be back there.
So she was she wasn't comfortable with Collins's fidelity.
She was just like, you're going to be high as fuck by the time you hit the stage.
Oh, okay.
So like, we can talk about that part of my life later.
Sure.
How much time you got?
We got all day.
so yeah, 3/15/14. So I was, by the time, I don't remember.
Sure.
Honestly.
Sure. But, it was the night before. So,
I don't remember. I heard I did really well.
Oh gosh. Where was this event?
It was at the VAC.
Okay.
Full House.
There's a
we raised a ton of money. I will say this. We raised a ton of money. I think it was for Alpha.
Sure. I was performing a lot at the VAC at that time or whatever.
It's
I had shows at the VAC a lot.
It's a great venue.
Yeah.
It's a great venue. Shout out to the VAC. Yo. Yeah.
Yo, Sam.
Woo. And yeah, I didn't drink any whiskey, but they were handing me pills like
oh,
nobody's
gosh.
Business. And I was drinking red wine, which is horrific.
Yeah, so you were true to your word of not drinking whiskey.
Absolutely.
Okay, but still.
And as a matter of fact, they brought us all up on stage afterwards and they handed us all shots of Fireball. And I did not do mine.
Well, okay.
Because I was true to my word.
Because you're not 14, because you're not a 22-year-old fraternity
truth.
Person.
And
sorority.
I promised my wife I would sure. not drink whiskey.
And she was in the audience, so she'd see it.
My tribe, as they say,
okay,
was in the audience.
Of okay.
So yeah, the next day I woke up and I sat straight up in bed and I woke her up. And I said, I don't know why I'm telling you this or why this is happening. But I'm not drinking or using anymore.
It was as straightforward as that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And from that morning forward, you've never ingested any foreign chemical with the purpose of
correct
filling that hole.
As a matter of fact, I broke my ankle 6 years or so ago and healed with Tylenol and ibuprofen.
Yeah.
It was literally the first miracle of being sober.
Because which was?
My sitting up in bed.
Okay.
And having that moment and understanding what that moment meant.
That is far out. What did you do right after that?
Cried.
Okay.
Because I didn't think she believed me.
Sure.
And
why
so
would she?
Then the next thing was, okay, I know I'm never using again. Fuck. What do I do now?
So pause on that for a moment. So that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Was that the first time you had ever made this declaration to yourself or to someone else? Okay. Okay. So to carry back a little bit, what was going on? I mean, we went from high school through to whatever point in your life that was. So yeah, I mean, talk about high school. I mean, I know you talked about or referred to being married to a man at one point.
Yeah.
So let's give me a little
bit of
that.
You want the whole, because
to the degree that you're comfortable, but
I'm fully comfortable. I just didn't want us to run out of tape.
Sure. I mean, I don't want to go minute minute by minute.
In a brief, after high school, I went to Austin, Texas.
Okay. For college or just to go there?
Well, that was how I got my parents to believe that I needed to go to Austin, Texas. But I went there to play music.
Okay.
And
play guitar?
Bass guitar.
Okay.
Then.
Okay.
And I played bass guitar in a band called Wake the Kids.
Nice.
It was the 80s. And and it was great. It was fun times.
So did you enroll at UT or was it just an excuse?
No, yeah. Okay. I started out at college.
Did you apply?
I told my parents I applied.
No way. They didn't even check to see if you had gotten in when you said you needed to go?
My parents loved me very much. I'm telling you,
so you're saying they just trusted you implicitly.
Yeah.
You had never gotten in any trouble.
I had never gotten in any trouble.
Interesting. Okay.
I've never been arrested.
Far out.
Yeah.
That is far out.
Yeah.
For a party girl living on the edge. I mean, I guess with upper middle class, sure. Okay. 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 So wind up in Texas.
So I wound up in Texas, played music for a few years, fell in love with a wonderful man named Gene Williams, who is a brilliant songwriter. Shout out to Gene. He lives in Oklahoma.
Oh.
He and I are still very much in touch. We were engaged. I freaked out, moved back to Virginia.
Sure.
and the guys went skiing. The band went skiing.
Okay.
And I packed my shit.
Was he in the band?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He was the lead singer, lead guitar player.
Okay.
Songwriter.
And
he and I wrote songs together.
Up until that point, were you living a hetero lifestyle always? Or had you already been aware of, or embracing, I suppose, attraction to other women?
Yeah, I mean,
because it's the 80s. I understand it's a different time today even the last 20 years.
I knew that I was attracted to women, but I'm also wildly attracted to men. I mean, there are men that I find wicked attractive.
Gotcha.
It's just that I find more women attractive than men. No offense.
none taken.
No offense to the breed, but...
Okay.
You know, for the men that I fall in love with are incredibly talented, incredibly gifted, incredibly gentle, incredibly mindful.
Sure.
And they're hard to find.
Sure.
Ask any straight girl.
Yeah.
They're hard to find, right?
Yes.
So...
Okay.
So instead of, but there are tons of women like that.
So you didn't get married. You were engaged and then
I was engaged to Gene and then I bolted when they went skiing.
Got it.
I packed up my dog and drove back to Virginia. I was
that's a commitment.
I was such a bitch. And he called and I wouldn't take his calls because I kept having panic attacks because I left him. And it was awful. Okay. And I was a mental health mess probably back then.
Well, because you were using, right? I mean, you were drinking,
yeah,
and drugging.
I was partying pretty hard. Okay. And so then I came back and I lived on my parents' couch in a massive panic attacks for 3 months.
Okay.
Before my father, God love him, looked at me and said, I have an appointment with my psychiatrist today and you're going with me.
Okay.
And I said, I can't get off the couch. I get dizzy every time I get off the couch. And he said, I'm picking you up and I'm putting you in the car.
Well,
and you're going with me.
Some of that getting dizzy sounds like withdrawal.
Partly, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the panic attacks were all because I was withdrawing and,
yeah,
you know, freaking out and having panic attacks.
Sure.
So
he got you medicated and...
So, yeah, the wonderful psychiatrist put me on Xanax.
Oh, look at that smile.
Chapter two.
Wait, because that's the one that's like basically a drunk in a pill, right?
It's fantastic.
Okay, yeah.
So.
Yeah, because Zoloft is the SSRI, but that's not a drunk in
a
pill.
No, Xanax is amazing.
Sure, that's all I've heard.
And God love benzos. So okay. that started my benzo career.
Okay. So this is your 20s. Your 20s were the benzos.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. And it got me off the couch, right? So I could start working and
So how long did you stay back east?
So then I got married.
Oh.
So so I moved to Richmond.
Okay.
This man
he's an older gentleman. My only thing that I recall is that you said he was a Vietnam vet. And I was like, quick did math. I'm like, that doesn't compute. Yeah. She's not that old.
Right. He was, first of all, I will say this, because he is also passed. And so I don't want to get bad chi.
Okay.
He was young when he enlisted. So he enlisted and he was like, he lied. He was like 16.
He's not necessarily going to be like 25 years older than you or something.
Right. Yeah. He was close.
Oh, was he?
Okay. He was involved in the evacuation of Saigon from 70 to 74.
Sure.
And he offered to pump my gas. That was, I pulled my car into a gas station in Richmond at an off ramp. And he was in front of me and offered to pump my gas. And I said, sure. And
did he say it like this? Would you like me to pump your gas?
No. That's why I mostly don't date men anymore.
Okay.
Thanks for being creepy. No, but he was like, hey, let me get that for you, uh-huh. Which was a cooler way to say that. And and then he was like, you want to get some lunch? And I was like, yeah. And it was that kind of relationship.
Very sweet. Okay.
Yeah, it was very sweet. Yeah. And like the day he proposed to me, we were at my parents' house and my mom and I were inside making potato salad because that's what we do in the South. and the guys were out on the back porch. At this point, my parents lived at a lake house and they were at the back porch on the lake. And I look out the window and my boyfriend is doing one-armed push-ups for my father.
Right, right.
And I looked at my mom and I said, what the hell? And she said, oh my God, he's going to propose.
That's awesome. That's amazing. He's demonstrating his worth.
And okay. He did.
So this is a nice love story. This sounds very sweet. Am I misinterpreting?
No, I
love
him.
How long were you together?
4 years.
Married for 4 years?
Married for 4 years.
Far out. Okay. And why did it end?
He was not a drinker.
Okay.
He didn't do drugs.
So he was like a teetotaler.
And I still partied. I still wanted to party.
Okay.
And I will say this. I mean, I think that that was the first really relationship that I cared about that I allowed my substance use disorder to destroy.
Okay.
And I love him to this day.
That's really sweet.
Yeah. So he was gentle and kind even when I was fucking up our marriage. And
it just had to end.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. What brought you to Idaho?
So I went from Richmond to Seattle.
Oh.
Moved to Seattle.
For work?
Lived there for, through a dart, kind of, and ended up in Seattle. My brother was in Seattle, so I had somebody there.
It was
that
Tom Hanks movie. It got you in.
Tom Hanks movie.
The Sleepless in Seattle movie.
I've never seen it.
I would just be ridiculous.
Yeah,
anyway.
No, I've never seen it. Although Meg Ryan's hot, so.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
Sorry,
what did you say? Your brother?
My brother lived there. Okay. My brother and I are, we're not going to talk about my brother this podcast, but we're estranged.
Oh, okay.
We're working on it now, okay. But.
Is it just you and he?
it is now. So my sister lived here in Idaho.
Okay.
Was a musician here for a long time. And
older or younger?
Older.
Okay.
So I moved to Seattle, and I lived in Seattle and met a nice woman and settled down with her for a number of years.
Okay.
And then same, right? Like my use has always sort of been the dragon that breathes fire on my relationships.
And it's effectively partying, right? You have you have work, you have responsibilities, you have relationships.
Doing work, doing all the things, and partying, but partying at a level where,
sure, like partying
you
hard.
Know, yeah, I still need whiskey in my coffee in the morning to make sure that my hands don't shake, right?
Gotcha.
So I was still there when I was in Seattle. My sister lived here and developed breast cancer and was 2 years from diagnosis to death. And I had been here to and from Boise because my sister and I were extremely close. And then when she got sick, I stayed here for quite some time.
Okay. This is in the aughts at this point?
I'm sorry?
Like the 2000s?
Oh, the aughts.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so British.
Sure.
Was that in the aughts? Yes, it was. We're going to do this for the rest of the broadcast.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, so in this was in I moved here in 2009.
Oh, okay.
So this was in 2000. This was early aughts.
When your sister
got
was diagnosed.
Sick.
Okay,
yeah. Got sick. Okay. And mid aughts. She was two years.
Okay.
And I really fell in love with Idaho. I fell in love with the people. I got to know her friends coming to and from. And
With Idaho or Boise?
Well, Idaho back then was
different.
Yeah,
it was different. Yeah, okay.
It was what I like to call rancher rules, right? So it was really, everybody's polite, everybody's kind. You take care of the people next to you.
Yeah.
And if you don't shoot my dog, you're fine.
Right.
Right? Like that was the deal. And it was before all of this crazy conservative religious, it's not even political anymore. It's straight up conservative religious fervor that has now leaked into politics.
Yeah.
And I moved here in 2009.
After she had passed?
After she passed,
Okay. And was that also running away from the relationship in Seattle?
Yep.
Okay.
And running into a grief process that I hadn't really started.
Okay.
And honestly, still haven't completed.
Sure.
Not sure I ever will with that one.
Okay.
My sister is still an everyday part of my life. Mm. And the greatest loss I've ever felt.
Yeah.
So, so that brought me to Seattle or to Idaho, to Boise. And I lived in the North End for a while and met my wife, my ex-wife.
Sure.
That relationship actually ended 2 years ago. And we're great friends. We're actually having dinner tonight. So,
nice.
We see each other two or three times a week and love each other very much.
So,
and
yeah.
She helped me get sober.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that, yeah, you move here and then about 5 years later, you have that mourning.
Yeah. It was a lot of hard partying here.
Sure.
The music community here parties really hard.
Sure.
And my sister had played music here for a lot of years. And most of the connections I had here were with musicians.
Okay.
And I fell right into a very comfortable spot in my role in society.
My role in society. Well, do tell. What was that role?
That was, you know.
What role?
I was the one who always was up to party.
Okay.
Always picked up the tab.
Oh.
Always, I was always down. Like, it didn't matter.
So your role was, like, enabler, basically.
Yes, and enabled.
Right. Well, through that, you bring a community around you and make sure that it's all...
I was the party gatherer.
I see. Because in there, you did eventually get a degree of some kind. Because you were working as a social, as a
like, what the fuck, dude? So I actually got my well, you like, dude, how did you scramble out of that to actually get a degree? I actually have several. So
sure.
I got my bachelor's degree from the University of Washington,
right,
in anthropology.
While
I was in Seattle,
right,
I came down here and got my first master's degree from Boise State University in organizational development. So systems theory, how systems work.
Okay.
Sort of the psychology behind how organizations work.
Okay.
Through the School of Engineering there. And I got that degree in 2016.
Got it.
So I finished that degree sober.
I see. Yeah, you didn't necessarily start it sober.
No.
Okay.
And then I realized that organizations wasn't really the thing that I wanted to know how things worked, but it was more people.
Okay. Oh, and that so brought you to the counseling program.
Yeah. So that brought me to the LPC program at ISU.
Yeah.
And so I dove in again and got my second master's degree. And
yeah, that would have been about 4 years later, 4.5. Okay.
So
there we go. So you said that you had made declarations of, I'm going to kick this, I'm going to stop using, I'm going to stop drinking in the past. Talk about that. How often would that come? Was it a cycle for you?
Every time I got caught doing something.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, I am every single alcoholic out there, right? Mm-hmm. If I got caught doing something, it was, oh my God, I would just immediately start to self-chastise. I would beat you to the punch. I would, I'm awful. I'm horrible. I'm never doing this again. How can you love me?
Right.
Make them, you know, think that I'm going to kill myself and then feel all better when they tell me they love me again. And, and then it was the next day and I could start partying again. There's nothing. We're talking about stories,
right?
And stories don't usually hit on the ugliness that is this disease, right? We can talk about all of my using and the fact that I'm still alive, which is, honest to God, a miracle. And my disease hurt so many people, including myself. And oftentimes we don't talk about that as anything more than collateral damage.
Okay.
And as human beings, I feel like we have a responsibility, every single human being, to do no harm, if nothing else.
Okay.
If nothing else, do no harm. And by not getting help for this disease, we are living against our responsibility every single day. And so I carry with me the burden of the joy of being sober and the joy of being clean and the burden of knowing how hurtful this disease was to so many people in my life for long.
Who's in your mind right now?
For so long. Everyone.
Okay.
I mean, honestly, I can go from the first guy who took a bullet for me and said he was the only one drinking, right? When we were 13.
Right.
You know, like I think about that guy. Name is Randy Smith.
Randy,
he had red hair. He, like, I remember his face like it was yesterday. Mm. And I think about him every single day. Every single day.
Really?
Because I lied and my lying hurt him. His parents thought he was this horrible human being. How could you be so motivated to get drunk alone at 13?
Okay.
Right?
Right.
And I let him take all of that on. Yeah. From that moment forward, I was a tornado, right? Like my disease was a tornado.
So talk about the shift. I mean, that morning you woke up and something felt different. And I mean, it takes more than just a declaration to make a personality change like that.
Yeah. I've been asked that before.
Okay.
And that, I think that's why I call it the first miracle of my sobriety,
yeah.
Because I literally, I can't tell you.
Okay.
I wish I had the answer. Like, oh, okay. I did this and that. And then I woke up and knew I had to stay sober.
Right.
It was a miracle. I don't know. That word is so overused, but I don't know. I sat up and I said it. And when I said it, I knew it. And I didn't know what came next, but I knew it wasn't going to be whiskey and I knew it wasn't going to be pills. And I don't know. Call it anything. Call it higher power. Call okay. it
That's where I'm
mom.
Sitting is if,
call it, you know.
It feels like a spiritual shift. And tell me about your feelings on yeah. spirituality. Like going through all of that, even as a kid and then yeah. today.
I've always been really spiritual.
Okay.
Although it's definitely shifted. What I thought was spirituality was not. It was emptiness.
What do you mean? Like when you were a kid?
Yeah. I mean, I like to say I'm spiritual because that makes me seem
sounds
like
so
I'm
cool.
not. Well, it sounds totally cool. Like I'm spiritual and I, you know, do opiates and like, damn,
okay.
I got to meet that girl, right? And I'm Buddhist. So mm-hmm. I've been meditating and praying and for a long time.
When did you adopt that?
Early. My parents were Methodist, shocker. And, but when I was 9, I said, I don't want to go to church anymore. And they were like, okay, baby.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Okay, okay.
They love me so much. Their love is amazing. A parent's love like that is probably what made me sit up in bed and say
okay.
that I was going to be sober. And they probably couldn't have had the power to do that until they passed away.
Okay.
So,
okay.
But yeah, so I've never really veered away from Buddhism. I've just
you were a 9-year-old and you start exploring Buddhism?
No, so okay. 9-year-old, I said I don't want to go to church anymore.
Okay,
they were like,
okay.
Fine. I went through a period 14-15 where I was involved in a Christian youth group.
Sure.
Because that was all the rage.
Sure.
And the youth pastor was really hot, and he had a. And he had a plane, so we would
an
like...
airplane?
Yeah, so he drove a Cessna. He flew a Cessna. So we would climb in the Cessna and fly to from Northern Virginia to like down to Ocean City, Maryland for dinner. So that was pretty dope.
That would get you on board with Jesus.
I love Jesus. I love Jesus. Jesus was
it's
a Cessna.
Really funny to hear you say that.
Yeah, I loved Jesus really hard back
okay.
then.
Okay.
So, and that, for reasons I won't talk about again here, faded away
okay.
and
okay.
I left. And yeah, and then I sort of discovered Buddhism because I didn't want to practice any sort of spirituality with people.
Okay.
And I knew that I could be Buddhist and be a soul practitioner.
Okay.
Like I really didn't need a community around me to do that.
What about it? I mean, besides just, okay. What I'm hearing is like, I'm interpreting that to mean like spiritual connection is very private, very personal.
Yes.
And so having a community feels foreign to this very personal sense.
Perfect.
Okay. Okay.
Wow. I wish you were a therapist.
Oh my God.
You'd be really good at it.
So how old are you? You're like in high school at this point that you adopt,
yeah.
or discover or
yeah.
whatever you want to say, embrace Buddhist.
Yeah. Start to, I found it more when I was in Austin.
Sure.
Practiced
okay.
a lot more there.
Okay. I'm very unfamiliar with like official Buddhism, I guess, or like.
So am I.
Okay. That's my where I'm going is like, what does that mean to you?
You know,
exactly?
it's more of a philosophy than it is a religion, which is why I embraced it. I think originally I became very bitter with religion.
Sure.
Extremely bitter with religion.
It seems to only go one of two ways if you embrace Christ.
Yeah. Love him or hate him. Yeah, so I loved him.
Gotcha.
And then I realized his people were kind of assholes. So,
sure. Okay.
So, yeah. Jesus was, I think, an amazingly cool dude.
Sure.
And very enlightened. Don't get me wrong. As was the Buddha.
It's a fictional character, but sure.
As was the Buddha.
Yes. Okay, so through all the years of partying, there's a... Okay, you said it already. That's the sense of spirituality, but kind of a prideful spirituality and an ego boost attempt
always.
To make you look good.
I always used spirituality.
Say that again. I used spirituality.
Yeah.
Okay, as a manipulative tool.
Absolutely. All the things. Being Christian got me what I wanted.
Got you.
Not being Christian got me what I wanted. Selfishness is... something that we all know really well.
Sure. So talk about that shift after that morning then. Like how long before that began to creep in also this sense of, the selfishness is running deep.
That was AA.
Okay.
So if we fast forward, so I sit up in bed. I am now sober. By the way, I wasn't hungover, which is
should
terrify everyone. Everyone. I rarely got hungover at this point in my career.
That's some pro shit.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was baller, dude.
Yeah.
Seriously,
I
baller.
I believe it.
So, so I didn't know what to do. I didn't post on Facebook. A friend of mine posted on Facebook that she had been sober a year.
Oh, okay.
And I reached out to her and I said, holy shit, I'm at this place.
Right.
How did you go to like meetings? What did you do?
Right.
And she said, no, it really only took my daughter to videotape me drunk once.
Oh, okay.
And so I didn't need meetings. And I posted back, okay, cool. And then, and then somebody private messaged me. And she said, hey.
Oh, because you were, this was on a
this is on a
post.
Facebook thread,
got it,
right?
Got it, okay.
She said, hey, my name's Charlotte, and I'm an alcoholic. And if you're serious about looking for help, I have a meeting that I go to on Wednesdays.
Okay.
And I'm happy to meet you there. And I was like, oh, fuck.
Right.
This is real. And... I can't do this alone.
Okay.
And I realized that that was the mistake I had made so many times before, understanding that I can't do it alone.
Right.
And so I went to that first meeting and she met me outside and I was nervous.
Sure.
Oh my God, I was terrified.
Sure.
If anybody out there is listening to this going, should I go to a meeting? Yes, you should. And you're going to throw up.
Yeah, you're going to feel like a weirdo.
It's awful. She met me outside. We sat in the grass. She was like, you know, this is me. Mm-hmm. Bunch of women in there just like me, just like you. If you want to feel like you're not alone anymore, I want you to follow me inside. And I had to think about it because I didn't know if I wanted to not be alone anymore in this.
Well, it also means a lot of things.
Which I didn't know at the time.
Sure.
I didn't know what walking in the door meant.
Okay.
I just meant, I knew it meant there were other people in there that may or may not be like me.
Sure.
And at the very least, I could prove that I wasn't them.
What was that first meeting like for you? Maybe what was the third meeting like for you?
Actually, I could say the first meeting felt the same as when I sat up in bed.
Okay.
And it's funny because like my hands are tingling right now.
Right.
Like just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Not because I'm like terrified.
No.
But because it was just magic.
Yeah.
Something
you didn't expect and can't explain. It
just really wanted to hate.
Sure. Sure.
And I walked in and here are these women and they're so kind. Yeah. And they were like, hey, sit down. Don't worry about it. We'll don't do anything you don't want to do.
Well,
we don't jump you in here. You
that
know?
Feeling. That feeling
not this of, meeting.
That feeling of love is so unexpected from these strangers.
And it was pure.
Right.
They didn't want drugs for me.
Yeah. They didn't want anything from you.
They didn't want sex for me.
Right.
Most of them.
All right. No, I do know what you mean, though. It's a pure, like, they want me here because they can just tell that I want to be here.
And they know that I belong here.
Right. Well, now I was avoiding that statement, but yeah, they can tell that.
They knew.
Yeah. Well, the spoiler for everyone is if you're walking in a room, you probably need to be here, right?
Right. Absolutely. If you have to ask the question.
Yeah.
Go to a meeting.
Yeah, yeah,
like if you have to take the test online, if you sit down at your computer
exactly.
and Google how to tell if I'm an alcoholic,
yeah, you,
just get the fuck up and go to a meeting.
That's the test.
Get up. Just go.
I'm a huge, I subscribe to that big time.
Yeah. So, and meetings for me, you know, I started a new meeting on Sundays, which unfortunately I can't go to because I work on Sundays now.
Sunday. Oh, wow.
But I have been... So in my 10 years, I have been in and out of meetings.
Sure.
But I've always had this one home group of women. And when I say in and out of meetings, I don't mean for extended periods of time. I mean, I start to feel pretty good and then I fall off for 3 or 4 weeks and then I realize I'm binging Oreo cookies and okay. I should probably get my ass back to a meeting.
Oh, okay.
Or, you know, so it's always been a part of my life, but AA is not a central part of my life.
Right.
So, yeah, but my first struggle was honestly the whole, you know, finding a higher power thing.
Sure.
Because even though I was Buddhist, the thing about Buddhists is spiritual Buddhists, not religious Buddhists, is we don't believe that Buddha was God.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have that sort of higher power thing. It's all very linear, right? It's all like very horizontal in structure.
Okay.
And so that was my first struggle.
Okay.
Was, you know, well, you need a higher power. I'm like, fuck off.
Well, yeah, tell me
Jesus,
about this.
Y'all. No.
Yeah, tell me how you, I don't know, square that for yourself.
They held a lot of space for me. And I would say this to anyone who actually has meetings right now regularly. Hold space for the people who are fighting that construct.
Sure.
It's... it can get crammed down your throat in AA, and it's really hard to stay in a meeting when that happens.
No, that's one of my biggest turnoffs, and I've had them not that long ago, kind of threw it at the group's feet at one point, after which I was like, nah, I didn't need to do that. But no, I completely agree.
Yeah, I mean, people will get there. I got there. The first struggle, finding a higher power for those folks who are struggling with that, that's not struggling to find their higher power. Like, that's bullshit. Nobody is struggling to find their higher power. I believe that humans all innately understand that we are connected to something bigger.
Okay.
It's struggling with your addiction. Like, that's your first out gate.
Oh.
When they say, you know, find your higher power, that's your first outdoor. As somebody who's coming in, you can go, oh, this is where I can tap out.
Got it.
This is where I can call bullshit. I can say, you all are a religious organization. Fuck you. I'm out. You're a bunch of old, white, privileged assholes.
Okay.
And language alert, sorry.
You don't need to worry
about
that.
And so for those of us, I think, who struggle with that higher power, we're struggling with our addiction.
Okay.
We're not struggling to find a higher power. We just need to make really sure that we're ready to quit. That's all we're doing.
I love that.
So give folks the grace to do that and hug them through it. And higher power will come.
Yeah.
That's not what it's about. Don't be offended by that.
That's beautiful. So what was your way through that?
Grace.
Okay.
Through a room of beautiful, amazing, compassionate, wise women who chuckled a little bit every time I argued about higher power and hugged me twice as hard every time I did.
So what do you do today? I mean, how do you square that for yourself today? The higher power concept.
I'm a weird hybrid of things.
Okay.
My Buddhist nature is very real.
Yeah.
Doing no harm, minimizing your footprint, loving everything around you and being grateful for it,
right,
and being present, and understanding that the energy, the current that runs through all of us, the rivers, all of it, is higher as a collective energy than any separate energy.
Right.
So we are collectively such a high power. There is no higher power.
Right.
The problem with humans is it's so rare that we can all do it in harmony. But yeah, I mean,
what I'm hearing is it's more of a sense of peace and peace and quiet and calm that is the connection to a higher power, whatever that means.
Yeah. Present.
Yeah. Being present is the connection to a...
Being present is the connection. I think having empathy is the gateway.
Okay. Because I'm using that word or that term, higher power, because it is the... It's just the...
It's the word.
Right. But this is similar to my own struggle with my own, you know, conscription of it is like it's... me, not like I feel like I'm higher power, but I'm the person having my experiences and I'm in connection with it.
Yeah. But we're all dumping into this big, beautiful pool, right?
Yeah.
Of data. If you think of it as data, right? We're all data collectors and we're all getting all of this data of our own experiences.
Yeah.
And that data is all flowing into a single data pool. That data pool is the higher power,
ooh,
right? And
like
that data
Jungian collective consciousness kind of thing.
Yeah, that data pool couldn't exist without all of our experiences, which is why the homeless guy in the corner's experience is just as valid as mine.
Okay.
Without his experience, our higher power loses energy, right? So empathy is the way to it. We have to understand that we are all equal contributors.
Really love this. Okay.
So
I don't think I've heard this framed like this. I really like this. That's beautiful.
Yeah. It's a beautiful life.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful life. It is. I work with a group of men who remind me it's a beautiful life every single day.
Yeah. Yeah. I am interested in the for myself, entering into the counseling program, especially when working on the idea of working with addictions, right? I mean, my own experience in AA, in recovery, there's a certain mindset. It's, you know, you're an addict, so blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But people coming in for counseling aren't necessarily at that point, right? They're coming to counseling. They're not coming to AA.
Right.
And I know for myself during the class specifically talking about like how to approach this, I found myself struggling with like, well, how do I approach someone with empathy when my bias, my internal thought is, well, you have a problem. Here's what you do.
Yeah.
How do you square that? Or did that even, was that a struggle for you?
It wasn't a struggle for me.
Okay. Okay.
Mostly because there are people that can come to me, and I have a lot of people who come to me with addiction issues.
Okay.
I work in a prison for those who, I work in a medium security prison, men's prison here in Boise, in CUNA, actually. Shout out.
Okay, man.
That's right. CUNA Caves, what? So that's about all their... I'm sorry, that in the prison.
Oh, geez.
Cut that. So I have a lot of men who come to me who have addiction issues.
Yeah.
They have a whole lot of issues.
Of course.
Right? I'm going to deal with whatever it is they want to bring to me.
Okay.
I can't help someone with their addiction if they're not really willing to walk it in the door. So I deal with folks with what they walk in the door with.
I got you.
And eventually it might come to addiction stuff. It's one of the reasons why I lead with my life, right? So that people are comfortable.
That seems very appropriate and beneficial for the role you have at work.
Yeah. Well, and there's no shame in it.
Exactly. That's my point. Like leading with that, presenting it, there is no shame. So whatever you're walking in with, this is where I'm at.
That's and it shouldn't be people who work in prisons. That should be what everyone, like that's empathy.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. It's just empathy. It's I love you wherever you are, and I'll help you get wherever you say you need to be. Hmm. That's all we do as counselors. That's all we should do as counselors. And that's enough.
Yeah.
Right? That's enough.
God damn it, I love you.
Thanks.
So how long have you been working out there? For a few months now, right?
It's almost a year.
A year, okay.
Almost, yeah.
Is there, I mean, tell me about this experience.
It's been humbling, beautiful. I am, in a lot of areas, extremely liberal.
Okay.
I have a lot of problems with Idaho's prison system.
Okay.
Huge problems. For a long time, Idaho's prisons were for profit. They're not anymore. They're now run by the state again. And therefore, there's no money. And there are plenty of things that prisons do wrong because they're prisons.
Okay.
And by their nature, they're unnatural. So I work within one now, and I do that because I work for the inmates, and regardless of how they got there, they need health care,
right,
whether it's medical or mental, which, by the way, is bullshit that they're separate. I'll throw that out there. Sure. Mental health is nothing more than brain health.
Right. It's a really odd.
Yeah, stopping stupid society. And anyway, it's an
odd distinction that's tried to be, they try to hold.
They. Ridiculous. They, those people.
Sure.
So I have this gift of working with some amazing humans who have made some really shitty choices.
Okay.
No, that's all choices.
Okay.
The shitty ones for reasons that may not have been theirs, but.
Yeah.
Shitty choices.
Well, I mean,
and it's frustrating and it's beautiful.
Okay.
All at the same time. And I learn something every day. 65% of the people I see are sex offenders.
Okay.
I thought that was going to be a really difficult thing for me. And I found grace in that prison working with folks with sex offenses. And I have found, empathy for who they are and regardless of their crime.
Right.
And, it's been a beautiful experience. And I'm also handcuffed, no pun intended, by the system itself.
Of course.
And so I'm really looking at trying to start a private practice. Where I see mostly felons on the outs because
like
they
after
don't.
They've been after
yeah,
they've
once
out.
They were released, because it's really difficult for them to find mental health outside of the prison.
Sure.
And the work that they've started in the prison then stops, and they usually end up using again, most of it substance use, most of it methamphetamine now.
Okay.
They'll end up using again and right back in prison if they don't have good mental health care. So for me, it's a matter of, okay, how do I get on board with Medicaid and.
Right.
Because that's most of what they carry.
Right.
And then God love rich people. I'm hoping to have a good private pay practice that'll help supplement and keep me paying the bills. But these folks need help. They really do. Yeah. And they're good people.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing now.
I am speechless. This is a beautiful talk. I mean, is there anything else that you want to add about your life, your history, or whatever?
I don't think so. Except for maybe I don't think my graduate experience would have been the same without you.
Oh.
There. So I would like to say thank you for that. There were definitely weeks where I felt like I was just going to tap out.
Oh,
and
sure.
You're aware of that. And,
yeah, that's right.
And I had some difficult things happen during the course of the program, and you were always just there and open and loving and kind when you needed to be, and dark when you needed to be. And
well, like I said, I felt a connection with you that was beyond the room of the school, right? Like I don't know. I mean, maybe it was just knowing the addiction side and the recovery side and being a grown up. Experiencing life in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think together we kind of kicked ass.
I do too. It was terrific.
And I like where we are now. You know, I think we left the school with something to think about. And I still go back. There are still a couple of folks that I'm mentoring who are graduating.
Oh, have you been back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's nice. A couple of folks that I've been mentoring who are graduating in June. At May.
Not and, me, man.
like, hell no.
No, and, I just, yeah.
And that's part of it too, right? Like, we need good practitioners. And I know that there are people in that school who are in the same place that we were, frustrated and angry and emotionally drained. And
yeah. What's the nature of the program, man?
It is. So. And for those who make it out, I want to make sure that they understand that it's worth it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I go back, and I'll keep going back unless they, you know,
God
kick
damn
me
it.
Out.
You're just such a better person than me.
No, I'm really not. I'm sleeping with the professor. No, I'm kidding.
My
I'm
God.
Not. I'm not. 100% not really doing that. Yeah. God, now I'm not going back. But no, so I think it was great to connect with you in that way and to get close with you in that way. And I don't know, maybe we can, you know, do something in a private practice one day and make a difference in the world. That's, for me, I didn't want to get in politics and I didn't want to get into the legislative stuff. And we don't have a choice if we live here.
Yeah.
We have kids who are killing themselves because they can't get the medical care they want. In July, that's going to get worse. Mm-hmm. There's a bill that's passed. I will go political for a second because there was a bill that passed that goes into effect in July that says that no state funds go for gender affirming care.
Right.
Which means that our prison system now has transgender women living in male prisons with breasts who are going to start growing beards in a male prison and have raging hormones as women. In a male prison.
Yeah.
Tell me how that makes any sense.
I didn't realize that was across the board. I thought it was still for underage.
No, it's state funds, right?
Funds,
so the attorneys for the Idaho Department of Corrections, the attorneys are looking at what loopholes there are, how we can continue. But so that's ethically something that I couldn't continue to work in the prison. If that goes into effect from an ethical standpoint, I have to leave the prison.
Oh, you're going to feel like the need to leave. Oh, I see.
It's malpractice. Hmm. Okay. It's malpractice.
Yeah.
And anyone who has a license should leave.
That is truly not something I thought of. That's not where I thought you were going to go with that either.
Yeah. Breaks my heart. Hopefully our legislature will stop hurting people with words and laws.
Right.
And realize that they're not saving anyone's souls. Yeah. They're just killing human beings.
I don't have an optimism about that with this legislature, not during our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Which...
It's going to take a lot.
Yeah. All right, Collins. I really appreciate you taking the afternoon, some time this afternoon to sit down with me.
Sure.
All right. I love you.
I love you.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
When I'm sober, which will probably be